This lecture is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas Chana Chaya Bas Mendel Olea Sholem, a blessed memory. In the previous lecture, we traced the history of Darwin's theory, some of the phenomena that he witnessed that prompted him to arrive at his theory, some of the weaknesses of his theory, as well as the view of David Luria, the Radal, in his Pirish, in his commentary to the Medrash Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer, which was published 7 years before Darwin's Origin of Species. The Radal was a proponent of a more modest form of evolution, i.e. pre-programmed genetic changes which occurred within the boundaries of the created mean, the specific created type, i.e. species or genus, which were triggered by environmental factors. We discussed his opinion, and this is also the opinion of the Netziv, Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the author of the Hamak, this is Hamak Dover, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the Yeshiva in Volozhin, the foremost yeshiva in Lithuania in the 19th century. Their theory is that the minim, the varieties that were created, were really limited. And they evolved from those varieties within their boundaries into the various forms. The David Luria quotes the Medrash of the Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer that there are 365 minim, or variety of animals, 365 variety of birds, 365 variety of rodents or lizards or whatever, it's just shrutzim. And really, that within these 365 categories, there was much evolution. And in fact, Noah, according to them, in the flood, only took these major groups, examples of major groups. He did not take every single animal. And these groups subsequently evolved into the various forms that we have today. We also quoted some supporting studies, which were cited by Dr. Lee Spetner, about the idea that genetic change can be triggered by environmental factors. Which is, again, this is not Darwinian evolution. Since Darwin's far-reaching theory spawned or gave justification to many of the various movements of the 19th and 20th centuries, including Marxism, Nazism, and the general moral decadence and agnosticism of modern and postmodern Western society, as we explained in the previous lecture, it behooves any thinking person to acquire a deeper understanding of the strengths and the weaknesses of this theory, a theory that still holds sway even today, despite all of its apparent weaknesses. Through such an analysis, I believe that a person also ultimately gains a greater appreciation of God and Judaism, as well as an understanding of how the Jewish people, who at the time Darwin wrote his book were overwhelmingly Orthodox and relatively well-learned in Torah, gradually began to reject the Torah and embrace the various modern movements whose worldview was shaped by Darwin. Briefly, Darwinism and the rejection of the biblical account of creation is supported by three major pillars. That's besides that which we explained in the previous lecture, about which we seem, which we explained, and possibly in the light of that Medrash and David Luria, what he saw was through the various islands, he saw various changes. Perhaps they were still within the species or the genus, but he did see a distribution which made him think that really that all of these different forms were not individually created, but really came from an ancestral form which evolved, which we explained, which is also explained according to the evolution of Rav David Luria and Tziv. But the general theory of evolution, the idea that not only were there small changes, we call microevolution, but this major change, that everything began from a single cell and evolved, this general theory of evolution is supported by three major pillars. The first is homology. The fact that diverse life forms often have a common body plan, where such commonality doesn't seem to enhance the engineering of the organism, at least as was viewed by Darwin and his disciples. This was viewed by them as a proof that these varied life forms must have had a common ancestor whose descendants still retained some vestigial traces of their ancestry, despite the illogic of the retention. The argument is that an intelligent creator would never have created such non-functioning or under-functioning organs, such as an appendix, for instance. But something created haphazardly through chance variation or mutation could well have be expected, says, to be flawed. That's the first pillar. Homology, where we see a commonality of structure, which seems to indicate that they had all a common ancestor. The second pillar is embryology, that the embryo supposedly retains vestiges of its previous evolutionary history in the various stages of its development. Ernst Haeckel, an evolutionary biologist and philosopher, was a follower and contemporary of Darwin, coined the now famous phrase ontogeny, meaning the development of the fetus, reenacts phylogeny, the stages of evolution. Such a phenomenon only makes sense, argued Darwin, if evolution is indeed true. If each type of animal was uniquely created and never went through the various evolutionary stages, why should manifestations of lower life forms appear in the embryo? There was also another support to Darwinism from embryology, of which we will soon speak. The third pillar is paleontology, the study of fossils and the reconstruction of life in the various prehistoric stages of the Earth's existence. The appearance of gradual evolutionary change throughout the fossil record seems to strongly support Darwin and his theory. It's perhaps no coincidence that the beginning three letters, you know, H of homology, E of embryology, and P of paleontology, spell out the acronym HEP, similar to the word hep, which spinned off a related word hip, which today both mean something that's trendy and modern. You know, like the phrase, you know, like he's hip, or the social phenomenon of the hippies of the 60s. It's also an expression of joy, as in hip, hip, hooray. But its derivation has a very interesting yet disturbing history. According to some historians, the word hep was originally an acronym for Jerusalemo est perdita, Jerusalem is destroyed. Hip, hip, or hep, hep, was shouted at Jews by German knights during the Middle Ages, meaning that Jerusalem is destroyed and the Jews are damned and have nothing to hope for. It was also the slogan that the Crusaders used on their march to Jerusalem, expressing their hope of displacing the Muslims and rebuilding Jerusalem as a Christian city. Hep is an anti-Semitic slogan, was revived in the early 19th century by the nascent German anti-Semitic nationalist movement that began in Würzburg, Germany in 1819 and spread throughout the country. It was this nationalism, coupled with anti-Semitism, that climaxed with the rise of Hitler and the Holocaust. In a spiritual sense, the acronym HEP, HEP, for homology, embryology, and paleontology, the bulwark of Darwinism, was just as destructive. But the odd thing is that today, the many critics of Darwinism use these very three pillars to totally discredit Darwinism and to prove that all major life forms were specially created and designed by an intelligence and could never have risen spontaneously by chance through evolutionary change. I'd like to analyze each one of these pillars of Darwinism separately, as each one gives us an insight into what made Darwinism so compelling and why today it is evident to so many that it is flawed. First, homology. Molecular biologist and medical doctor, Dr. Michael Denton, author of Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, pointed out, no one has ever presented the argument for evolution based on homology, similarity of structure, better than Darwin himself. In Darwin's own words, this is taken from his sixth edition of The Origin of Species, on pages 434 and 435. We have seen that the members of the same class, independently of their habits of life, resemble each other in the general plan of their organization. This resemblance is often expressed by the term unity of type, or by saying that the several parts and organs in the different species of the class are homologous. The whole subject is included under the general term of morphology. This is one of the most interesting departments of natural history and may almost be said to be its very soul. What can be more curious than the hand of a man formed for grasping, that of a mole for digging, the leg of the horse, the paddle of the porpoise, and the wing of the bat should all be constructed on the same pattern and should include similar bones in the same relative position. How curious it is to give a subordinate, though striking instance, that the hind feet of the kangaroo, which is so well fitted for bounding over the open plains, those of the climbing, leaf-eating koala, equally well fitted for grasping the branches of trees, those of the ground-dwelling, insect, or root-eating bandicoots, and those of some other Australian marsupials should all be constructed on the same extraordinary type, namely with the bones of the second and third digit extremely slender and enveloped within the same skin, so they appear like a single toe furnished with two claws. Notwithstanding the similarity in pattern, it is obvious that the hind feet of these several animals are used for as widely different purposes as possible to conceive. The case is rendered all the more striking by the American opossums, which follow nearly the same habits of life as the sum of their Australian relatives, having feet constructed on the ordinary plan. Professor Flower, for whom these statements are taken, remarks in conclusion, quote, "May call this conformity of type without getting much nearer to an explanation of the phenomenon." He then adds, this is quoting from, is it not powerfully suggested of true relationship of inheritance from a common ancestor? And Darwin continues, "Nothing can be more hopeless than to attempt to explain the similarity of pattern of members of the same class by utility or the doctrine of final causes. The hopelessness of the attempt has been expressly admitted by Owen," this is Richard Owen, "in his most interesting work on the nature of limbs. On the ordinary view of the independent creation of each being, we can only say that so it is, that it pleased the Creator to construct all the animals and plants in each great class on a uniform plan. But this is not a scientific explanation," end quote. In other words, to Darwin, similarity most strongly suggested common ancestry and not independent creation. To this day, homology is cited as a strong support for evolution. The problem with this proof, however, the problems are numerous. First of all, it is clear that there are many similar structures throughout the animal world that even evolutionists agree are not the product of common ancestry. The phenomenon is called analogy or convergent evolution. For example, one example is the similarity of the bone structure of the flippers of the whale, which is a mammal, and the ichthyosaurs, the extinct marine reptiles who lived at the time of the dinosaurs, which had a body which is like a porpoise, with dorsal and tail fins and paddle-shaped limbs. They're not related, but they're the same. Another example of non-related but similar structures is the great similarity between the structure of the eye of the vertebrates, those animals with backbones, and the eyes of the cephalopods, the octopus, the squid, the cuttlefish. It seems evolutionists agree that one doesn't come from the other, but yet they're so similar. Or take the cochlea, The snail-shaped tube in the inner ear where sound vibrations are converted into nerve impulses, which is similar in both birds and mammals, but do not share a common ancestor who possessed such a structure. We can't say that the cochlea of the mammals came from the birds. According to evolutionary theory, they both came from reptiles independently, but yet so similar. Another fascinating example of analogy, convergent evolution, is that of the placentals. Those mammals where young grow to completion within the womb, connected up until full term to a placenta, which provides oxygen, nutrients for the fetus, and transfers its weights. These are the majority of mammals, and the similarity to the marsupials, like the kangaroo, where their young, after initial stage in the womb, attached to a placenta, transfer to a pouch where they complete their embryonic development. Now, these two separate groups have many analogous structures, although, even according to the evolutionists, they do not share a common ancestor who possessed such structures. For instance, there are marsupial dogs. There were the thylacine, known as the Tasmanian wolf, which is now considered extinct, even though there's still reports of sightings, which is almost identical in its outer structure to a placental dog. There are marsupial mice or rats, the bandicoots. There are marsupial cats, moles, and flying squirrels. As Dr. Michael Denton pointed out in his Evolution of Theory and Crisis on page 178, quote, although as a marsupial, the thylacine was quite unrelated to the placental dog, it was incredibly similar in gross appearance and in skeletal structure, teeth, skull, etc. So similar, in fact, that only a skilled zoologist could distinguish them, end quote. In other words, similarity of structure does not necessarily prove common ancestry. These similarities would seem to point, on the contrary, to a preconceived plan, rather than the evolutionist explanation of so-called convergent evolution, in which hundreds or thousands of similar mutations, chance flaws in the DNA occur time and again in totally dissimilar organisms, ultimately creating by sheer coincidence amazing similarities. Another difficulty with homology has to do with the very proof that Darwin offered, the form of the human hand. As you recall, Darwin argued, quote, what can be more curious than the hand of a man formed for grasping, that of a mole for digging, the leg of the horse, the paddle of the porpoise, and the wing of the bat should all be constructed on the same pattern, should include similar bones in the same relative positions, end quote. The problem is, as Dr. Michael Denton pointed out, according to evolutionary theory, the front limbs evolved from the pectoral fins of the fish. The hind limbs evolved from the pelvic fins. Their evolution occurred seemingly independent of each other. Yet despite the fact they're unrelated in terms of ancestral relationships, the arms and legs, the hands and feet are virtually identical in design. To have occurred by mere chance is simply incredible. On the contrary, it would seem there must be a preconceived design that is the basis of these similarities. Another problem with the proof that homology, common structure implies common descent, is the fact that the areas in the genes that code for these common structures are often in very different places. And in addition, they often develop in the embryo differently. What makes matters worse is that Darwin himself defined homology as, quote, that relationship between parts which results from their development from corresponding embryonic parts. As he assumed that the similarity is not only in the outer structure of the adult, of the final, the mature, but it really is a reflection of that they're similar in the embryo. There are countless examples that show that this is simply not true. Let me just give you two. In terms of embryonic development, for instance, the forelimbs of newts, lizards, and humans, was the front hand, which seem to be homologous, actually develop from different areas of the embryo. As the late Dr. Gavin de Beer, professor of embryology at the University of London, and one of Britain's foremost biologists pointed out, This is a monograph which he published through the Oxford University Press in 1971 entitled Homology and Unresolved Problem, page 8. It says, four limbs in a newt develops from the embryonic trunk segments number 2, 3, 4, and 5. In the lizard, numbers 6, 7, 8, and 9. In the human, numbers 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, and 18. Another example is the kidney. This is homologous in fish, amphibians, as well as reptiles and mammals. They all have kidneys. Here again, their development differs. In the words of Dr. Denton, this is on page 146 of his work, in fish and amphibia, the kidney is derived directly from an embryonic organ known as, this is the mesonephros. Like this, it's called the middle kidney. While in reptiles and mammals, the mesonephros degenerates towards the end of embryonic life and plays no role in the formation of the adult kidney, which is formed instead from a discrete spherical mass of the mesoderm and develops quite independently of the mesonephros, end quote. By the way, the mesoderm, the derm is skin, so meso is middle. So it's the meso is the middle layer of cells in the embryo that develops into muscle and bone and cartilage and blood and connective tissue. In the words of Dr. De Beer, quote, it does not seem to matter where in the egg or in the embryo the living substance out of which homologous organs are formed comes from. Therefore, correspondence between homologous structures cannot be pressed back to similarity of positions in the cell of the embryo or parts of the egg out of which these structures are ultimately differentiated, end quote. Just as these similar structures develop by the embryo differently, even more significantly, is that they are programmed in the DNA of the genes in entirely different areas. In the words of Dr. De Beer again, this is page 15 of his monograph, quote, because homology implies community of descent from, continues on, a common ancestor, it might be thought that genetics would provide the key to the problem of homology. This is where the worst shock of all is encountered. Because characters controlled by identical genes are not necessarily homologous. And homologous structures need not be controlled by identical genes. And homology of phenotypes, means outward makeup, does not imply similarity of genotype, end quote. Dr. DeGaven asked the question, quote, what mechanism can it be that results in the production of homologous organs, the same patterns, in spite of their not being controlled by the same genes? I asked this question in 1938. It has not been answered. This is, end quote. From a creationist view, of course, the final product was pre-planned. The means of fulfilling that plan is, of course, based on the infinite wisdom of the planner. I would just like to dwell a few moments, however, about the significance of that plan. From the viewpoint of the Torah, the number 5, you know, the humans, mammals, reptiles are called pentadactyls. Notice that there are 5, you know, we have 5 digits. The number 5, from the viewpoint of Torah, has significance. It represents the 5 books of Moses, the Chumash, the 5 commandments on each of the tablets, the Luchos, the Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu brought down with him from Sinai. That idea is well attested for. The number 10 occurs not only in the total number of commandments on the tablets, but also in the 10 statements, Maimoros, that created the world, the 10 tests of Abraham, Avraham Avinu, the 10 plagues. According to the Kabbalah, this is the mystic tradition, the number 10 represents the spheros, the creative and sustaining spiritual acts that created and continue to shape the world. The idea 10 front and back, all told 20, manifests itself physically in the 10 digits in the front and hind limbs of the the hands and the feet. But spiritually, it manifests itself also in the Luchos, the tablets, which according to the Talmud Yerushalmi was read both ways. As there was 10 front, you turned it around, you could read it 10 in the back. It's also the idea of the double tens is also a Kabbalistic notion. There's the direct light of the ten spheres, that's from God to us, and the reflected light from us back to God, about the stages. In other words, the design in the animal world has a correspondence in the structures of the Torah. By the way, the number 20 also represents the basic building blocks of life, the 20 amino acids which form the proteins of which your bones, muscles, nerves, practically every major structure in your body is made. In fact, according to the Kabbalah, as we discussed in the previous lecture series, every part of you, all 248 limbs and 365 sinews or blood vessels, represent and correspond to a higher spiritual reality. Accordingly, this basic body plan, which is shared to a certain extent in the animal world, is the product of design rather than chance. To give you a deeper insight into the significance of the number 10 and number 5, let me quote you from the writings of the Maral, in his commentaries, Pirush de Pirkei Avos, Sefer Derech HaChaim. But first, I would like to directly acquaint you with some of the basic sources where their number 10 appears. And that's in your handout here. The first page we have, with 10 divine utterances was the world created. This is taken from Avos in the 5th chapter. We'll be reading from the 1st to the 6th Mishnah. What does this come to teach us? For surely it could have been created with one utterance. This was to exact punishment from the wicked who destroy the world who was created with 10 utterances, to bestow goodly reward upon the righteous who maintain the world who was created with 10 utterances. There were 10 generations from Adam to Noah, to show the degree of his patience, for all those generations repeatedly provoked him, Hashem, until he brought upon them the flood, the Mabul. There were 10 generations from Noah to Abraham, to show the degree of his patience, for all those generations repeatedly provoked him until our forefather Abraham, Avram Avinu, came and received the reward of all of them. Our forefather Abraham was tested with 10 trials. And again, the idea of 10 keeps on repeating. And he withstood them to show the degree of our forefathers' love for God. 10 miracles were performed for our ancestors in Egypt, and 10 of the Red Sea. 10 plagues did the Holy One, blessed be, bring upon the Egyptians, and 10 at the Red Sea. With 10 trials did our ancestor test the Holy One, blessed be he, in the wilderness. As it is said, they have tested me these 10 times and not heed my voice. 10 miracles were performed for our ancestors in the Holy Temple. 10 things were created on Sabbath Eve at twilight. The idea of 10 keeps on being repeated. There's a Gemara in Ksubas on page 2 we have, in Kufdalad Amad Aleph 104a. Rabbi, this is Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, who the prince of the time of his passing, raised his 10 fingers towards heaven and said, Sovereign of the universe, it is revealed and known to you that I have labored in the study of the Torah with my 10 fingers, and that I did not enjoy any worldly benefits even with my little finger. But again, there was a significance of 10 fingers. May it be thy will that there be peace in my resting place. A voice from heaven echoed, announcing, He shall enter in peace. They shall rest on their beds. And speaking about in the other world. And again, we find the number 10 just common in Jewish life. How do you know that if 10 people pray together, the divine presence is with them? This is a Gemara in Brachos and Vavam at Aleph and 6a. For it is said, God stands in the congregation of God. In other words, the idea of minyan of 10 is based on the uniqueness of the number 10. What does 10 signify? And here we're quoting from two sections from the Maral in his work. This is Derech Chaim. The first quote is from his commentary to the third chapter of Pirkei Avos. This is the 6th Mishnah. And he explains the significance of 10 as follows. Because 10, when it stands alone, is a comprehensive number, meaning merging the individual integers into a unit of 10. There's a unit of 10s. In our system, the decimal system, there's the ones, but there's the 10s, and there's the hundreds, 1,000. But the first after you have the individuals from 0 to 9, the first multiple that has answers of a 1 is 10. It merges into a single unit of tens. It is associated with Hashem, for it is a number which represents an entirety. Because that's the idea of 10. As he's going to explain in further detail, the idea of 10 represents, in a certain sense, a multiplicity, because there's 10, but really which merges into a 1. Like the number 1, we just see 1. In number 10, we see there's 10 parts which form a single unit of 1. And because the number 4, now he's going to the significance of the number 5. Number 4 is a number which represents division, as it corresponds to the four directions, and then, you know, in a plane. You have north, south, east, and west, to which a thing is naturally divided. It is that reason the scripture uses that number to symbolize division, as it says, "For I spread you abroad like the four directions," referring to the golus of diaspora. This is because the four directions are distinct and separate. For this reason, the fifth, when it is between the four, unites and connects everything. For that reason, the fifth is called aguda, a bunch or cluster. He's explaining the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos about the significance of five. For this reason, the Shekhinah would have an affinity with the number five more than any other number below 10. I mean, in a certain sense, we find this idea of oneness even in a hand. There are four fingers, and you have the opposing thumb that puts them all together. That's about five. So we have one idea of the oneness of, you know, for multiplicity, you know, it's like the it's the motto of the United States of America, you know, e pluribus unum. That's from the many into one. We have another idea of the ten. Remember, we discussed the idea of ten spheros. These are the 10 stages of how God interacts with us. The Maral in his writings never deals with spheros, even though much of it is based on Kabbalah. He speaks of it in philosophical language. And this is the following quote is from the first Mishnah of the fifth chapter, the fifth parak in Pirkei Avos. This is the one we quoted all the instances of 10. You should know the fact that the world is created with 10 utterances and not through one utterance is indicative that this world has a special spiritual quality and that Hashem and His Shekhinah, divine presence, are manifest in this world. This is because 10 has the sense of spirituality. Again, he doesn't say why, but it's an allusion to the spheros. The number 10 is identified with this concept because the Shekhinah is always present when there are 10, but no less. But we've again explained the number, why 10, because it really represents, the number 10 represents the process, which we've discussed in detail in the previous lecture. From Keser, Chochmah, Bina, there's all the 10 spheros. So that number has a significance, and that's why it keeps on reappearing. In a certain sense, then, we would look at it from a mathematical viewpoint. Our whole mathematical system is a base 10. It doesn't have to be this way. You know, when they wanted to teach the new math, they wanted to get kids familiar with other systems. I mean, the whole binomial system, the whole computers is based on a base 2. So just to get them to think. So it doesn't have to be 10. It could be a base 9 or a base 8. Why is our whole system base 10? Well, it's easy to say we have 10 fingers, you know. But why do we have 10 fingers? I mean, so it really, according to this, no, it comes because they're 10 spheros. It's like it starts the other way. 10 is the number with which God uses. And therefore everything else now is, his imprint is 10. It's like the fingerprint. Like God's fingerprints are all over. So that's why we have 10. So every time we have 10, it's the symbol of the Shekhinah, of God's presence. And it continues on, "Therefore, had the world been created with only one utterance, the world wouldn't have had wouldn't have been on this special spiritual plane. It's indicative that we're 10. It's indicative of the nature of this world. And it continues on. All of this is alluded to in the verse in Isaiah 26. It says, Ki b'ko Hashem tzur elomim, for the Lord God is an eternal rock. Which is also understood, says, be Yud and He, through the letters Yud and He, did Hashem, God, create the world. The world to come, this is from a Gemara Menachos and Chavtes on the Beis in 29b. The world to come is created with the letter Yud. Again, Yud represents spirituality. It's also very interesting that the number is 10, but the sign of the letter, the Hebrew letter Yud, at least in Ksav Ashuri, this is the present script that we use today, not the Ksav Ivri, the ancient Hebrew script, which we've touched on in the previous lecture, is really just a point. I mean, it has a little swiggle on top, but basically it's a point. If you're familiar with mathematics, a point takes up no space. It's really the smallest entity. It represents spirituality. So it has the idea of 10. There's a number. It's a large number, 10. But its symbol is like nothingness. For the numerical value of Yud is 10, which represents spirituality. I'm quoting from the Maral, which is the reason that the Shekhinah has an affinity for that number. Again, he puts it, Yud is Olam Haba. But ultimately, Yud is Olam Haba, 10, because there is a significance of the number 10. This world, however, was created with a He. The world was created with a Yud and a He. Yud is the upper world, and He is the lower world, and this combination is God's name. It's important to realize that it was Reb Chaim Volozhiner, he was the primary disciple of Vilna Gaon, explains that all the names of God that we have are not a description of God into himself. We have no idea. We have no conception of God himself. They are names which represent how he interacts with us. So with that we could understand the Yud and the He. The He he had just explained before is the idea we have a multiplicity. We have four, which represents four directions, but it's combined. You have a midpoint, you know, which combines them all. In a certain sense, he continues, he has a slightly different view here. It's complementary. This world, however, is created with a He, for the He is composed of two parts, which alludes to the fact the world has two facets. The physicality of the world and the connection it maintains with the spiritual world. The two parts of the He are the Dalet and the Yud. You know, the He is written again, Ksav Ashuri, our script. You have a Dalet and a little Yud on the lower left-hand corner. You should know that the Dalet represents the dimensions of width and length. You know, it's this way and that way. As the form Dalet has one horizontal line and one vertical line, and therefore alludes to the expansion of the area of the earth in directions of width and length. That's basically on the plane or whatever. It's like the four directions, which represent the beginning stages of the physical world. The point, which is, and this is because he created with the hay, so first they have to create space, you know, I mean. You create a physical world. We understand today, I mean, after Einstein, that space is also creation. So you have to create space. The point which is within the Dalet, part of the He, you know, the He part, which is on the lower left-hand corner, which defines it as a He, is somewhat separate from the Dalet, which is indicative that this world does receive some spiritual radiance from the ethereal world and is not totally physical, but it stands alone. Therefore, the Yud is placed within the Dalet, which receives it, but yet is not touching it, as the ethereal does not combine with the physical. So that's the symbolism of He. Now you look at your five fingers, you look at it differently, right? Accordingly, the world to come was created with a Yud. This interpretation is clearly evident. For this reason, the world was created through 10 utterances, for had it not been created so, it would have been on a lowly level, but now that it was created with 10 utterances, it is indicative of its higher spiritual status. That's the important why it was created. With 10, it's giving you a message. From this, you can understand why the world was worthy of being created with 10 utterances, for this world issued forth from Hashem, who is one. Therefore, it is not possible that his actions should not be indicative of his oneness, for every action carries with it some identifying mark of its source. So, one idea is 10 represents spirituality. And everything that he does has the imprint of the 10. The second aspect of number 10 is similar to what the previous quote is, that of multiplicity, which is befitting the creation of the world, as the number embodies the very essence of this world, which is multiplicity, for there's no true one except Hashem. As if this would all be one, we'd have a sense of, you know, it's all, you know, we're godlike. The sense that it is separate, is there were layers upon creation, is indicative we're created. This multiplicity manifests itself in the separate sections or parts which make up the world. It would have made sense for the world to be created through 9 utterances, for this is the maximum of individual parts before they merge as part of the group of 10, as I explained above. Since the world, however, has an aspect of unity which is reflective of its creator, as well as an aspect of multiplicity reflective of the creative act, which expanded and multiplied into different parts, as I explained above, similar to a tree which has many branches, which in turn subdivides into various parts of the tree, as well as a trunk which unifies all of the parts. Therefore, befitting that the number 10 should be used, as the single integers do not reach completion, oneness, till they merge together and form the number 10, as I explained above. It is for that reason that the worlds are created with 10 utterances, as befitting that the number of creative steps should be indicative of the nature of the action as well as the one who brought about the action. The nature of the action, which is multiplicity, is indicated by the number 9. The aspect of the creator is reflected by the number 10, which is indicative of the creator. In summary, the 10 utterances through which the world was created are indicative of the state of completion, oneness of this world, as well as the fact that the world receives spirituality from Hashem. This is reflected by the number 10. As you see clearly, it's not easy learning the Maharal. Yeah. But basically what it's saying is, and what we're bringing it here, is that we look at the world, it just didn't happen. The world that we see reflects a plan. And the fact is, we have 10 fingers means that in God's eyes, the number 10 is very significant. And the fact that we have 2 hands, each one is a 5, is indicative the 5 is very significant. And if we put that into the fact that the world was created with a hay, so really our hand is really represented of this number 5. So the fact is that monkeys have 5 digits, or in the flipper of a porpoise there are 5, or a bat has 5. You're saying this is God's, you know, imprint. That's the Maharal. I want to quote now from a sefer before we get back into the science. It shouldn't be said you didn't learn any Torah here. Yeah. I want to take from a classic Kabbalistic sefer work. This is from Eliyahu's Dividash. This is called the Sefer Reishis Chochma. He was from the great Mekubalim Kabbalist who lived in Sfas and Safed in the 1500s. He was a Talmud, a disciple of Moshe Kodaviro, which we discussed at length in a previous lecture. So if some of it is above your head, don't worry about it. But I just want to give you a sense of what is the master plan. The following, and this is again, this is taken from the Sefer Reishis Chochma, Shara Hava, you know, it's the gate to the section called of love, Perek Vav, 6th chapter. The following is a quote from Tikkuni Zohar, page 123a. Quote, this is Reishis Chochma speaking, Eliyahu Dividash. All of these organs have a spiritual counterpart in the spheros. You know, you look at yourself, they not only, which is yourself, of course, but really it represents, it corresponds to a spiritual entity. The head represents the Keser Elyon, the highest crown. The brain corresponds to Chochmah, wisdom. The heart to Bina, understanding. And through it, the heart has the faculty of understanding. The two arms corresponds to Chesed, kindness, and Gevurah, heroic strength. The trunk corresponds to the central column, to Pharis, which is beauty or splendor. The two legs correspond to the spheres of Netzach, leadership, as we explained, and Hod, inner beauty. The organ of procreation corresponds to Yesod, foundation. The sign of the covenant, the bris, corresponds to the Shekhinah, divine presence, the sphere of Malchus, or royalty. End quote. This is taken from the Tikkuni Zohar. And he continues on, a student of Kabbalah can gain a special insight into the master plan, especially as it applies to humanity, by studying the Idra, which is part of the Zoharic literature. Through it, one can know the reason why a man has a beard and women don't, and other differences between them, as well as why there are 32 teeth and a tongue in between them, why the eye has three colors, as the pupil is black, the iris is blue, green, or brown, the sclera is white, the design of the ear, which is made up of chambers, why there are 10 fingers in the hand, not 8 or 6, which we touched upon before, why there are some total of 28 joints in the arm and fingers. So similarly, one can gain understanding into the structure of the trachea and esophagus as to why there are 6 rings in the trachea and why the esophagus is white on the inside and red on the outside, which alludes to the divine nature of Hashem. Further gains an insight as to why a man walks upright and not on all fours like an animal, because man is similar to the angels who stand erect. And he continues on. But basically, he's saying that the plan of man reflects a higher plan. So yes, why are they similar? Because that's the basic plan. And you can understand, if that's the case, then why is it that the hands and the feet have the basic plan, even though, according to evolution, it's supposed to have descended from the fins, you know, the front and back fins, which, because they're the same, because it reflects the master plan, not because of happenstance. Before we begin the next section, we're back to the science now. I'd like to touch upon an issue that's related to Darwin's view of homology, and that is vestigial organs. According to Darwin, homologous structures are often mere vestiges of ancestral forms. Evolutionists building upon Darwin's thesis have claimed over the years to have found many organs or structures which are clearly vestigial, which seem to serve, in fact, absolutely no function in the organism, clearly inconceivable if we were created by an intelligent designer, but understandable in the light of the unpredictable and often inefficient process of evolution through natural selection. In the year 1895, Ernst Wiedersheim published a list of 86 organs in the human body that he claimed to be vestigial. This is in addition to almost another 100 structures he felt were useless. In fact, in the famous Scopes trial in July of 1925, the defense brought to the witness stand Horatio Hackett Newman, a zoologist from the University of Chicago, who stated, quote, there are, according to Wiedersheim, no less than 180 vestigial structures in the human body, sufficient to make a man a veritable walking museum of antiquities, end quote. That list included the tonsils, the thyroid gland, the thymus gland, the pituitary gland, the pineal gland, the appendix, and the coccyx, all once thought to be useless and expendable. That's why, by the way, there used to be so many tonsillectomies. Everything's just an accident why you have tonsils. In an article in Evolutionary Theory in 1981 entitled, Do Vestigial Organs Provide Evidence for Evolution?, S.R. Scalding, a zoologist at the University of Guelph, Ontario, pointed out that for two reasons the existence of vestigial organs cannot serve as evidence of evolutionary theory. First of all, after analyzing Wiedersheim's claims, he had difficulty finding even a single item that did not serve a positive function, at least in some minor way. And second of all, he argued, which is a philosophical argument, it's impossible to demonstrate conclusively that any organ or structure has no function. Maybe you just didn't find it yet. And hooray, they did find it. I mean, it would be a bitter tzara if a person took out his thymus gland or his thyroid gland. You know, that's vestigial after all. I mean, so you just don't know a reason doesn't mean no reason exists. Okay, this takes us now to the next section. We did the H is homology. The E is embryology. At the beginning of this lecture, we briefly discussed Haeckel's law that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. In other words, the embryo, in its succeeding stages of development, takes the form of its supposed ancestors. First becomes like a fish, then an amphibian, until it becomes a human. In Darwin's words, this is from The Origin, page 345, with many animals, the embryonic or larval stages show us, more or less completely, the condition of the progenitor of the whole group in its adult state, end quote. This was a law that was widely preached and included in texts on biology and evolution, usually accompanied by Haeckel's own illustrations of the embryo to demonstrate this law. As a young man, I personally viewed a copy of Haeckel's illustrations, as probably did many of you, and to tell you the truth, it looked quite impressive. The only problem with all of this is that Haeckel's law is absolutely false, as well as the illustrations that Haeckel made to prove it. In the words, let me just quote you, Dr. Sabin Swabenthan, this is an article in Parents Magazine, October 1979. Fetoscopy, there's a little, probe that you can put into the uterus to see the fetus, makes it possible to observe directly the unborn child through a tiny telescope inserted through the uterine wall. Development of the child from the union of the partner cell to birth have been studied exhaustively. As a result, long-held beliefs have been put to rest. We now know, for instance, the man in the prenatal stages does not go through the complete evolution of life from a primitive single cell to a fish-like creature to man. Today it is known that every step in the fetal development process is specifically human, end quote. In addition to Haeckel's supposed law, Darwin found yet another support for evolution, another one of Haeckel's observations of embryonic development. To use Darwin's own words from his work, The Descent of Man, quote, the human embryo itself at a very early period can hardly be distinguished from that of the other members of the vertebrate kingdom, end quote. And since humans and other vertebrates pass through the same early stage of development, this is quoting also from Darwin, we ought frankly to admit their community of descent. One cannot underestimate the weight that Darwin put to the supposed strong evidence of evolution. Quote, it seems to me, Darwin wrote, this is from The Origin, this is chapter 14, page 346. The leading facts in embryology, which are second to none in importance, are explained on the principle of variation in the many descendants from some one ancient progenitor. Darwin was convinced that, quote, the embryos of the most distinct species belong to the same class are closely similar, but become, when fully developed, widely dissimilar. In a letter to Dr. Asa Gray in the year 1860, he wrote that he believed that this phenomenon is, quote, by far the strongest single class of facts in favor of his theory, end quote. Since Darwin himself was not an embryologist, he relied on the evidence supplied by others, especially Haeckel, of whom Darwin wrote in his Origin of Species, quote, he brought his great knowledge and abilities to bear on what he calls phylogeny, or the lines of descent of all organic beings. In drawing up several series, he trusts chiefly to embryonical characters, end quote. In other words, he felt this is the proof. You see, they're the same. And again, if they would be created distinctly, why should they look so similar? And in Haeckel's own words, quote, we see that a certain stage, the embryos of man and the ape, the dog, the rabbit, the pig, and the sheep, though recognizable as higher vertebrates, cannot be distinguished from each other. The fact can only be elucidated by assuming a common parentage. I've illustrated this significant fact by juxtaposition of corresponding stage in development of a number of different vertebrates in my natural history of creation in my anthropogeny. How accurate was Haeckel? Dr. Michael Richardson, embryologist at St. George's Medical School in London, discovered that no one had systematically checked Haeckel's claims by comparing human and other fetuses during development. He assembled a scientific team and photographed the growing embryos of 39 different species. Interview in the London newspaper The Times, published in August of 1997, he stated, quote, "This is one of the worst cases of scientific fraud. It's shocking to find that somebody one thought was a great scientist was deliberately misleading. It makes me angry." And he continues on, "What he did was to take a human embryo and copy it, pretending that the salamander and the pig and all the others look the same stages of development. They don't. These are fakes." In the paper, we call them, quote, misleading and inaccurate. That's just polite scientific language. Besides for the fact that it's now clear that these various animals never look the same in any of the stages of their development, because of the confusion that Haeckel wrought through his now discredited illustrations, I mean, you know, I'm looking at this, we're dealing with the science, you know, at this point, we're looking at the scientific evidence before. Maybe, you know, how many Jewish boys studied evolution, looked at these pictures, and were convinced? And as a result, they never kept Shabbos, they never kept kosher. You know, just it's, you know, just important to realize the destruction that we see on a high level as a result of this. So it's hard to separate the emotion, but it's, you know, from just the cerebral here, the academic. But just important to realize, to a great degree, this has influenced the general community of Jews. But to continue on, because of the confusion that Haeckel wrought through his now discredited illustrations, there's a commonly held misconception that all vertebrates have, at a certain stage of their development, gill slits like a fish. The truth is that at that early stage of development, gills don't appear on a fish. All that a fish has in the embryonic stages are folds or line on its neck that later develop into gills, a very complex structure. In the words of the British embryologist Lewis Wolpert in his work, The Triumph of the Embryo, 1991, he writes, "This resemblance is illusory, and the structures in the mammalian embryos only resemble the structures in the embryonic fish that will give rise to the gills." Because they don't look like fish. And fish at that stage don't have gills. In fish, these folds in the neck region suddenly develop into gills. In the reptiles, mammal or birds, these folds develop into entirely different structures. There's the inner ear, the parathyroid gland. The only resemblance they have with the fish at that stage are the series of parallel lines in the neck region. But they don't have gills. Just important to realize. Another misconception of the Haeckel spread was the supposed similarity between all vertebrate occur in the earliest stage of development, only after that do the dissimilarities appear. This is the thing that Haeckel wrote, that Darwin writes. The truth is that the very first stage of the embryo, from being a fertilized cell to the early cleavage process, during which the cell subdivides to hundreds or thousands of separate cells, to the process known as gastrulation, when the cells begin to move and rearrange themselves, establishing the animal's general basic tissue types and organ systems, the skin, muscles, intestines, the various animals, fish, amphibians, reptile, bird, mammal, look entirely different. If there's any resemblance during the stage of development, it would have to be between a frog and a human, which has looked quite similar, at least in the pictures, in these stages, at least in comparison to a reptile or bird, which according to evolutionary doctrine are closer in ancestry. It is only after gastrulation that the embryos look close enough in appearance that Haeckel felt comfortable enough to doctor his pictures. In other words, the various vertebrate animals do not look at all similar in the earliest stages of the embryonic development and only possess a very strained similarity later on. This, of course, undercuts any support at all from embryology to Darwin. And now this brings us to the P. So the H was homology, the similarity of structures. The E is embryology. Now the P is paleontology. Although the so-called proofs of homology and embryology are generally only familiar to students of biology, the proof from paleontology, the fossil record, is familiar to all. The illustrations of early life forms, such as a dinosaur, is a part of American culture, from movies, cartoons, magazine articles, and televised shows. We have dedicated whole museums to preserve the remnants of life forms that no longer exist. And it is the fossil record which would seem to pose the greatest challenge to the biblical account of creation. According to the generally accepted interpretation of the fossil record, the fossilized animals and the rocks in which they lie represent millions upon millions of years of the world's history recorded in stone. Through the slow but uniform process of erosion, sedimentation, glaciation, vulcanization, etc., over millions and millions of years, layer upon layer of rock formations and the buried animals or plants within them slowly rose and formed the present geological column. According to this interpretation, the most simple animals appeared first on the planet, were of course buried first. It seems that in most cases, the most simple marine organisms do appear in the geological record as the very first layer, what is known as the Cambrian period. The highest layer, known as the Pleistocene, represents the most recent fossils. This layer contains the remains of early man. This is all according to evolutionary theory. And the animals that lived together with him in the period which is referred to as the Ice Age. So we have the smallest, least visible organisms in the Cambrian era to the highest in the Pleistocene. Paleontologists divide the history of life on this planet into four eras. The earliest is known as the Precambrian era, which is said to have lasted almost 3.5 billion years. So if this takes a little time, this class, you know, don't be worried. It's all relative. The rocks from this era contain the remains of the earliest life forms, bacteria and primitive algae, which is said to have appeared almost 4 billion years ago. They also contain later and more advanced life forms, such as colonial algae and soft-bodied invertebrates. The next era, the Paleozoic, is said to have lasted almost 300 million years. At the beginning of this era, many of the advanced invertebrate phyla appear, and soon after, the earliest fish. At the end of the era, amphibians and then reptiles appear. The first period of this era is known as the Cambrian era, as Wales, England, which was originally called Cambria in Roman times, was where the first of these types of fossils were discovered. The next era, which is supposed to have lasted almost 200 million years, is the Mesozoic, the age of the dinosaurs. The last era, which has lasted some 65 million years, is known as the Cenozoic. Paleozoic means early animal life. Zoic is like zoo, means animal. And paleo is earlier. Mesozoic, meso is middle, which means the middle animal life, and Cenozoic means recent animal life. Precambrian refers to life before the Cambrian era, the earliest period of Paleozoic. According to evolutionary theory, the billions of years which have passed since life first appeared on this planet provide sufficient time for the evolutionary process to have taken effect. And the fossilized animals, as they progressed from the most simple and ancient to the most complex and recent, serve as irrefutable proof that evolution has indeed occurred. The length of the time since the beginning of the earth until now and how it is measured will be elaborated in a future lecture. I would just like to point out, however, there's considerable evidence which supports an alternate thesis that the world is in fact relatively quite young. According to this school of thought, which was first articulated in the non-Jewish world by the geologist George McCready Price and later by Drs. Henry M. Morris and Dwayne T. Gish of the Institute for Creation Research, as well as other scientific creationists, and to the Jewish world primarily by Rav HaGaon Avigdor Miller Zatzal, blessed memory. They view the fossil record as actually the record of mass catastrophe. enormous flooding and volcanic action, which was created in only a year's time during the Mabul, the great flood of Noah, leaving in its wake a tremendous record of death and destruction. The fossils, for the most part, according to this, are the life forms that existed before the Mabul. These include the dinosaurs, of which there's considerable evidence they actually continued on in some form even after the Mabul into the recent era, whereupon they became extinct, just like the dodo bird and the passenger pigeon, which have become extinct in recent history. The various proofs that they bring to their position will be discussed in future lectures. Needless to say, if the world is only some 6,000 years old, and the fossils were not formed over a great expanse of time, there's absolutely no evidence for revolution in the fossil record. However, even if we do accept that the fossils were truly formed millions of years ago, which is the commonly accepted opinion in the scientific community, it would seem that the fossils, instead of proving evolution, are one of the strongest forms of evidence that evolution, as at least it was envisioned by Darwin and his disciples, could never have occurred. As we're not dealing again with the evolution we discussed in the last lecture, according to Rav David Luria and the Netziv, that we have specific forms which change and all into different forms. But rather we're dealing from the first cell and slowly progressed all the way to what we have today. This is the argument of those associated with the intelligence design movement, such as Dr. Michael Denton, Professor Philip Johnson. As Dr. Denton pointed out, Darwin assumed a smooth transition from one species to the next with many intermediate forms in between. Darwin himself stated, this is from The Origin, page 408, quote, "The number of intermediate and transitional links between all living and extinct species must have been inconceivably great. But assuredly, if this theory be true, such have lived upon the earth." End quote. But wherever you look, we do not find the expected continuum from the invertebrates to the vertebrates, from the reptiles to the birds, from the most simple mammal to the most complex, all the way to man, but rather a discontinuum, separate types, meaning quite distinct from the other without any intervening forms. Darwin himself admitted in his Origin of Species, this is on page 307, the sixth edition, that, quote, the distinctness of specific forms and their not being blended together by innumerable transitional links is a very obvious difficulty," end quote. The problem was especially true of the various highly specialized organisms and organs to which Darwin confessed, quote, this is also in The Origin, on page 459, "it is no doubt difficult even to conjecture by what gradations many structures have been perfected," end quote. And to his friend Dr. Asa Gray, he wrote, this is September 5th of 1857, "imagination must fill up the very wide blanks," end quote. The problem with these missing blanks is that they're so enormous, as one evolutionist, Dr. Stephen Stanley, in his book Macroevolution, pointed out, that if our knowledge of biology would be restricted to living life forms, quote, "we might wonder whether the doctrine of evolution would qualify as anything more than an outrageous hypothesis," end quote. But if these transitional forms truly did exist, as Darwinists sincerely believe, notwithstanding difficult to imagine them, we have to ask ourselves, what happened to them? But to this, Darwin answered that they certainly must have died out, destroyed by natural selection. Only the most fit remained, a small percentage of the entirety of life forms that once occupied this planet. It would only stand to reason then that these transitional forms do not exist amongst the living. They must surely be amongst the dead. Unfortunately, the same intractable problem of finding transitional forms amongst the living also persists amongst the dead. There are virtually no transitional forms. Darwin himself realized that the lack of intermediate fossils seemed to prove that his whole theory was incorrect. And asked in his Origin of Species, quote, this is on page 406, "why then is not every geological formation, every stratum, full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory. The explanation lies, as I believe, in the extreme imperfection of the geological record, end quote. Darwin was hopeful that as more of the earth would be excavated, he would be vindicated. As he states his Origin of Species on page 414, only a small portion of the surface of the earth has been geologically explored, and no part with sufficient care. And we continually forget how large the world is compared with the area over which geological formations have been carefully examined, end quote. Well, over 100 years have passed since Darwin first wrote these words. So there's almost 150 years. How has the situation changed? There's an awful lot of people making a parnassah digging into the earth. Let me quote Dr. David Raup, curator of geology at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, which houses the world's largest fossil collection, who wrote the following in 1979, quote, "He, Darwin, was embarrassed by the fossil record because it didn't look like he had predicted it would. And as a result, he devoted a long section of his Origin of Species to attempt to explain and rationalize the differences. Darwin's general solution to the incompatibility of fossil evidence with his theory was to say that the fossil record is a very incomplete one." And he continues on, "Well, we are now about 120 years after Darwin. And knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. We now have a quarter of a million fossil species, but the situation hasn't changed much. The record of evolution is surprisingly jerky, and ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time. By this I mean that some of the classical cases of Darwinian change in a fossil record, such as the evolution of the horse in North America, have had to be discarded or modified as a result of more detailed information. What appeared to be a nice, simple progression when relatively few data were available now appears much more complex and much less gradualistic." End quote. The world famous Harvard paleontologist, the late Stephen Jay Gould, wrote in 1977 an article of Natural History, quote, "The extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as a trade secret of paleontology," end quote. The situation is truly amazing. Almost without exception, every single major animal group appears subtly in the fossil record without any intermediates. For instance, British biologist Richard Dawkins, today one of the foremost spokesmen for evolution, admits in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, on page 229, "The Cambrian strata of rocks, vintage about 600 million years, are the oldest ones at which most of the major invertebrate groups, and we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution, the very first time they appear, is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history," end quote. Although there are literally billions of fish fossils, in the words of one of the world's experts on fish, ichthyologist R. Norman, this is of the British Museum of Natural History in his book, A History of Fishes, and I quote, "The geological record has so far provided no evidence as to the origin of fishes." And paleontologist Gerald T. Todd, in a 1980 article in American Zoologist entitled Evolution of the Lung and the Origin of Bony Fishes, stated, quote, "All three subdivisions of the bony fishes first appear in the fossil record approximately the same time. They're already widely divergent morphologically, and they're heavily armored. How do they originate? What allowed them to diverge so widely? How did they all come to have heavy armor? And why is there no trace of earlier intermediate forms?" End quote. The next group on the evolutionary ladder, amphibians, also appear subtly in the fossil record. For years, evolutionists claimed that the extinct Rhipidistian, this is Crossopterygian fish, was somehow transitional to the amphibians until in 1939, a fisherman off the coast of Africa caught a live Crossopterygian fish of the genus Latimeria, known as the coelacanth. a fish that paleontologists were convinced had become extinct some 70 million years ago. They found to be a normal fish with absolutely any amphibian characteristics such as lungs or incipient limbs. I don't know how it makes for gefilte fish, but it looked like a regular fish. And as for reptiles, which supposedly evolved from amphibians, paleontologist Robert L. Carroll wrote in an article in 1969 entitled Problems of the Origin of Reptiles, published in Biological Reviews of the Cambridge Philosophical Society, quote, "Unfortunately, not a single specimen of an appropriate reptilian ancestor is known prior to the appearance of true reptiles. The absence of such ancestral forms leaves many problems of the amphibian-reptile transition unanswered." End quote. And what is true of fishes, amphibians, and reptiles is also true of the dinosaurs, which supposedly ruled the planet for nearly 200 million years. They emerge in the fossil record without any intermediates. In the words of Sir Richard Owen, one of the founders of the science of paleontology, the head of the Department of Natural History of the British Museum, and the one who coined the word dinosaur, which means, by the way, terrible lizard in Greek, quote, "The last ichthyosaurus," that's a marine dinosaur, by which the genus disappears in chalk is hardly distinguishable specifically from the first ichthyosaurus, which abruptly introduces that strange form of sea lizard in the Lias. The oldest pterodactyl, the flying dinosaur, is as thorough and complete a one as the latest." End quote. And this pattern of discontinuity is just as apparent in the class of mammals. In the words of the preeminent paleontologist and zoologist, the late George Gaylord Simpson, in his book Tempo and Mode in Evolution, says, quote, "This is true of all 32 orders of mammals. The earliest, the most primitive known members of every order already have the basic ordinal characters, and in no case is an approximately continuous sequence from one order to another one known. In most cases, the break is so sharp and the gap so large, the origin of the order is speculative and much disputed," end quote. These are only some examples of this phenomenon of discontinuity. From an evolutionary standpoint, if traditional forms really did exist, and they are many, many more times than those that exist today, it's truly amazing these life forms left absolutely no record. Especially in the light of the fact, as Dr. Michael Denton pointed out on page 189, of the 329 living families, you know, they're you know, divided into phyla, you know. You know, there's families, genus. Living families of terrestrial vertebrates, 261, or 79.1%, have been found as fossils. And when birds, which are poorly fossilized, are excluded, the percentage rises to 87.8%. As you will find of the living ones, you'll find them in the fossil record. Amongst the 43 living orders of vertebrates, 42 or 97.7% are represented. If all of those transitional forms actually existed, we should have expected to see similar results. That's why both the scientific creationists, those are those who believe in actually 6 days, that the world is only some 6,000 years old, or according to them, maybe 10,000 years old. And members of the intelligent design movement, which feels that the world is actually billions of years old, but denies evolution, feel that the fossil record is the greatest proof that evolution never occurred. If it happened, where are they? But if what I'm saying is true, why does evolution persist as a scientific discipline? Why are there so many adherents? Besides the fact that most scientists have not studied evolution in depth, together with its numerous problems, from a scientific, meaning a naturalistic viewpoint that doesn't allow, by definition, an outside intelligence or God to intervene, there's no other explanation of the complex and ordered existence of life on this planet. To answer that it was God that created it, although apparently true, is just not scientific, as they define science, and therefore unacceptable as an explanation. In addition, philosophically, evolution has great appeal. After all, is a disturbing question of how can a compassionate God allow for the suffering in the world and the pervasive death and destruction is recorded in the fossil record, assuming, of course, it is not simply the record of the great flood of Noah, of the Mabel. Furthermore, metaphysically, the idea that there exists a continuum of life, that all existence is related, and the hope of continued progress that evolution seems to predict is very appealing. But as we pointed out, all of the evidence points otherwise. In the words of Professor Louis Agassiz, one of the most influential scientists of the 19th century, in his book Methods of Study in Natural History, which was published in 1863, 4 years after Darwin initially published his Origin of Species, I quote, "It is my belief that naturalists are chasing a phantom in their search for some material gradation among created beings by which the whole animal kingdom may have been derived by successive development from a single germ or from a few germs. It would seem from the frequency which this notion is revived, ever returning upon us with a hydra-headed tenacity of life, presenting itself under a new form as soon as the preceding one has been exploded and set aside, that it has a certain fascination for the human mind," end quote. But if the fossil record is not a record of evolution, what is it? And how could someone who believes in the revelation at Sinai and the Torah reconcile the evidence of a very old earth, seemingly billions of years, with the Torah's chronology of 6 days of creation, less than 6,000 years of history? That will be the subject of the next three lectures, creation and the age of the earth. Now, are there any questions? Yeah?
As you had mentioned before, Darwin was looking at five or so different fin, a man's hand, the bat's wing, and trying to say how they had similarity. What do you do with all the other thousands of other species that have no similarities? Why was he saying, you see from these five, that's enough to make a generalization. And on the flip side, further to that question, by land, do you see these five in the multitude of other species and animal lives that we have?
Well, the five come out in the vertebrae, because they have, you know, it's, and in the vertebrae we see this. This is the plan of the vertebrae. But basically what he is saying is, basically, his notion is, well, if I would be God, I would have done it differently. And therefore, there can't be a God. I mean, can there be anyone more intelligent than I? And therefore, and that really is, it's very interesting. Much of the argument in evolution is a philosophy, is philosophical. It's a really metaphysical argument. But we pointed out, it has serious flaws. Yeah.
I didn't quite catch what you said when you talked about the horse in America. Could you maybe repeat?
One of the, again, I remember as a young man or as a child, still in school, in high school, studying about the evolution of the horse. There was the Eohippus, and as it goes down from the earliest horse, as it continues on, we see layer upon layer, and we see that it develops, into the hoof that it has now. The only problem is they kept on finding it just didn't work out that way. It isn't the slow, gradual thing. You have a horse like this, and you have a horse like that. They're really even reconsidered. This Eohippus was a horse at all. There's much of what they have found, it doesn't lend itself to these gradations. Sometimes they find it was really decided that it started off small, got bigger and bigger and bigger, right? Until we got to the black stallion, right? We got, So it just didn't work out that way. They got big ones and they turned small. I mean, it just kept on. They look at today not as this step, it really is a bush, and different ones came from different. They believe in evolution, but it clearly is not this proof for evolution anymore.
I understand the horse is not indigenous to the United States.
There used to be the horse. There used to be many horses here in this country, and they somehow became extinct and were reintroduced, by the Spanish.
Or DNA.
What about it? Yeah, you're asking about the thing about DNA and evolution. We're going to discuss that in a future lecture. But that's just too much for now.
Also, as far as the idea that there's evolutionary happenings even today, that they can, the scientists see, let's say, when something will change, viral evolution or bacterium that changes.
Yeah, so you're speaking about, you know, about evolution that we witnessed today. I touched upon it in the last lecture. Basically, this is the contention of Dr. Spetner, that really for the most part, when we find mutations are mistakes that are inferior, because you're taking something which works well, and it's like a typist making an error. Generally, though, we gave the example for sickle cell, this is anemia, for instance, that it's an unfortunate disease, it's very painful for those who have it. But what it does, though, that once this mutation occurs, I mean, or those who have this mutation, that there's a virus that creates malaria, whatever it is, the microbe that creates malaria, can't get hold of this. As normally, it gets hold of there's an area on the gene that gets hold of. Since it's misshapen, it can't get hold of it, and therefore it offers protection from, that particular virus. So there's a benefit here, but the benefit is only secondary. Basically, is you have a benefit on a misshapen, And he goes to show that by and large, most of what we find are really, they happen to have this positive secondary benefit, but really it's inferior. It really is not really a progression. But we went in detail then, and Mirza Hashem will discuss it, in a future lecture. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not even sure what my question is. I'm a bit new in this. Information, but I'm thinking some of the thoughts I'm having in terms of evolution versus creation. I haven't ever perceived them quite in opposing positions, because time can be seen chronologically, but also time is an hour spent with my dearest, closest friend is a very short hour compared to an hour spent doing something drudge that's just, like housework to me. So what I've always perceived is that in evolution, when God created the world in 6 days, it doesn't seem to fall into conflict for me, because a day for God may be very different than my small human day. Maybe.
Oh yeah, we're going to touch that on the next lecture. Okay. Yeah, we're going to touch about about time, right? Okay. But I'm just quoting now. Is there evidence for evolution having occurred?
Yeah. My other comment had to do is, well, I think of the mastodon and the elephant, which look so very similar. But some of my work in my past has been that of a social scientist. And some of the research that I've seen and read and assumed to be true is one study was of inner city children who over time have developed better peripheral vision than children from perhaps suburban or country safer neighborhoods.
There is, it seems that on a small scale, there seems to be much evidence of, or at least suggested of, evolutionary change. But that's within the structure. I mean, we all have eyes. We have better eyes. We have this. But if no one had an eye, and you want to create an eye, that's something else. There is much evidence, the idea, or at least strongly suggests, that there have been changes and there have been improvements or changes or lateral changes in what we have. that means that it's not fixed. But there's a difference of saying that and to saying that everything started from a single cell that developed into all these, of all this massive information that we have here. So that there's a difference between what we call macroevolution and microevolution. And as we said in the last lecture, that the idea of microevolution, there seems to be even rabbinic literature much support for that. And macroevolution is really, that was really the focus of today's lecture.
Okay. And the time will.
I don't know how fast this hour and a half went tonight. You know.
Can we say microevolution is the same as adaptation?
No, well, you see, adaptation, all adaptation really is saying is that there are changes that one, you know, that there's a constant change, and those that are better suited for a certain environment will survive, and the others won't. But really, the adaptation is within a certain framework. That's microevolution. So there is evidence strong for microevolution, but we said even in rabbinic literature, there's strong evidence for microevolution. Okay, good to know.